bring you in.
You got it.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Juror 13 show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin. For the next hour, I'll be your host. And tonight, I have a very special guest we're going to be discussing organized crime with. My guest is Mr. Andrew DiDonato, and he is a former associate of the infamous Gambino crime family out of New York City. His criminal career began in the early 1980s when he was a teenager growing up in Brooklyn, New York. For nearly 20 years, he lived outside the law on the streets or as a guest of the state behind bars. His crimes included fraud, robbery, burglary, loan sharking, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. After flipping and becoming a government witness, he has testified at several high-profile mob trials, including John Gotti Jr. Andrew, welcome to the Juror 13 show.
Thanks for having me, Dennis. Thank you very much. It's good. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Well, let me just tell the listeners that in a few minutes we'll open up the phone lines. If anybody has a question or comment for Andrew or for me, you'll be able to reach us at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. But first, I'd like to get a little background, Andrew. Now, you grew up on the streets of Brooklyn, or in Brooklyn.
Yes, and, I was. Okay.
And about how old were you when you started looking at crime, at organized crime, as something you were interested in?
Well, it wasn't so much of being interested in organized crime per se. I mean, I happened to grow up in a family that was organized crime oriented as it was. An uncle of mine who was a captain in the Genovese crime family back in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of people, like even my father, when I was a child, I was a young boy, my father went to jail. Most of our friends, it was the norm for my family. Most of the people we knew were involved in organized crime or on the fringes or knock-around guys, so to speak. So it was the norm for us. It wasn't something, you know, that I just, you know, wasn't used to. But I didn't go out and tried to start a career thinking I was going in that direction. What had happened was, you know, I was just, you know, into my younger teenage years. I was out with a few friends of mine every day, and we started, you know, robbing cars. And even back then, we didn't even know how to rob cars too much. We had to wait in front of newsstands for guys to leave their cars running back then. And then we would do other things, you know, rob tires on cars and front and back bumpers back then. I remember just small stuff, car radios, things of that nature. I had a friend of mine, we did some burglaries, some other stuff like that, and it's a very young kid. And what happened was we started to have an outlet for the things that we were stealing at a young age. And we were able to make a few dollars back then. And being that we were starting to make this money, we seen the greater picture where we could have started making even more money if we could incorporate it into actually stealing the cars. So we went from just regular hubcaps, tires and wheels, real petty stuff, to car radios, then moved on to cars itself. Then from the car business, we were just doing drop-offs and stuff of that nature. And the local wise guys around my area, I happened to live in the Canarsie section of Brooklyn at the time. And what happened was one of my neighbors was Joseph Carrazzo, who was happened to be right now, he's in prison right now, but he's the underboss of the Gambino crime family. Me and his two sons, we happened to be very good friends when we were kids. And what happened was, I'm committing crimes with guys that they know, younger kids, and you start to catch the eye of the local guys, which was JoJo's brother, Nicky, who ran that area. And one day, I just was, you know, robbing with my friends, whatever the case may be, and they had hung out with Joseph as well, and his daughter, Nicky's daughters and stuff like that. And then I just got invited to come to the club one day, and I was told that, you know, you're always welcome here. If there's anything you have trouble with in the street when you're doing the stuff you're doing, just come back to us. And a friendship developed. And then, you know, I also had an uncle of mine who was in the life, so I was able to, you know, speak on those terms, that this was my uncle, Blasey Blasey, back in his day. My uncle passed away in 1978. He was murdered. And I started to learn more about my uncle in his death than I did in his life, because I was really too young at the time to fully understand. So I started to become friends with people that were friends of his. And it just escalated like that. And I just got embraced with those people, and I was able to, you know, move up a little bit at a time doing odds and ends things. We wound up opening up a chop shop, and we made some really big money. We were dealing with a faction in our crew, the Roy DeMeo crew with Patty Tester and them. They had this big stolen car ring, selling cars across the country to Kuwait at the time. And
Kuwait?
Yeah.
Another country,
yeah. Yeah, the country, yeah. Okay. And what happened was, a friend of ours, Beansy, who was a little older than us, his name was Anthony Gibino, he stole with them for a while, and then he started stealing with us. And in doing so, we started to pick up those orders. So we started to make some really decent money in the early 80s. So what happened was, you know, as a kid, I'm making, I don't know, 5 or 6 drop-off cars a night. For myself, it was a decent pay. Plus whatever else that I could be doing in the street, you know, burglaries and, you know, little stuff, but it added up. It really added up. And then, of course, now we started to, as we were getting older, the crimes would start to escalate. Now, as we're getting older, we start to shake down drug dealers, you know, all the drug kids in the neighborhood. We'd shake them down each week, depending upon how big their businesses were. You know, for each drug dealer, I think in the early 80s, I think we were taxing them like $300 or $400 a week, depending upon what they were doing. Some guys more, some guys less.
When you say taxing, is that what they call a street tax?
It was a street tax. It was an extortion. And, you know, and being that they were already committing crimes, where are they going to go? They can't go to the police to complain about that we're extorting them. So a lot of guys would conform, and the guys who didn't, we would rob or put them out of business. And then what we did is we had so many drug guys underneath us at that time, we just started networking them. So if this drug guy that we were shaking down would tell us that his supply had dried up, we would go to another guy we were shaking down and make him supply him so we can keep on shaking him down.
Okay.
Yeah, so things of that nature. You know,
okay.
And then I guess, you know, back then in the mid-80s, you know, I started shylocking some money. I got permission from Nicky Carrazzo to put some money out on the street. And I was shylocking money at the time. And I worked in a horse room. Back then, they had satellite rooms. And, you know, we had the big satellite dishes on the roofs of the place. And we were able to get every racetrack in the country off the satellite. And people would come in. Instead of going to the racetrack, they were able to come to the club. They would get fed. They can come sit down. In some places, we didn't pay track odds for certain things. I think it was like 200-1 on trifectas or 300, whatever. I forget what the odds were. But they didn't have to go very far, and they can get all the things that they needed right there in the neighborhood. And I had a place on Stillwell Avenue on Bensonhurst. I had a place there for 2 years. And then I was making money on the sports aspect of it, you know, taking sports bets for football, baseball, basketball. And I made some pretty big money in the early 80s. And back then, times were different. You know, when I was part of the crew back then, it isn't like it is today. Back then, you felt you belonged to something. You know, it was one for all for one. You know, and then I caught a case in 1988 for a shooting that I was involved in, and I went to jail for a few years. I went to jail and, excuse me.
I was just going to ask you, we got a caller on the line. Before I take the call, I'm wondering now, just make sure I understand how these things work and make sure the listeners understand, is when you become part of a crew.
Yeah.
The money you earn, some of that goes to the crew or to the family. I mean, you don't keep everything you earn. You have to.
No, you don't keep everything you earn, and you work off percentages. It also goes by percentages. And it's like the luck of the draw as well. You know, you can get a boss who's a greedy, selfish mother. You know, excuse my language,
but
you can get somebody who's greedy who will want more than other guys. Mm-hmm. Other guys want. You know, when you're a young guy coming up, and they see you're out there in the street trying. It's not all about what you're hiding from them. They're not thinking that you're hiding from them as far as financial, what you're making. So they pretty much give you all the rope you need to try to make some more money because they see that you're trying. As you get older and your crimes get bigger and they get more elaborate, that's when they start to really watch the nickels and dimes of how much money you're bringing in.
Okay.
You know, but when you're young and you're up and coming, a percentage of our windup. A lot of the drug money that we shook down, we sent a percentage to it to Nikki each week.
Okay, let me take a phone call, and then we'll get back. I got some more things I want to ask you.
Okay.
954 area code. You're on the line. Go ahead, please.
Crime doctor, I've been listening in.
Oh, just want to listen?
No, this is Cobra, brother.
Oh, Cobra, how you doing tonight?
Hey, man, I wanted to listen in and see if you really did talk to live mobsters and stuff like that. I see what you do.
Yes. Much. Yes, enjoyable. That's why I'd like to get my education.
Let me tell you what, he sounds like a good old boy right there. And I was over at a friend's house, and I said, he's always acting like a mobster. I said, you ain't no damn mobster. You ain't no bounty hunter. You ain't no mobster. You're just a normal guy. Now, I'm going to turn the radio on and let you listen to a real mobster. And he said, just his head been blowed back. He says, them people don't know you. I said, that's the crime doctor right there. He knows everybody.
Well, thanks, Cobra. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, so I'm just going to listen in. You guys go ahead and talk here a little bit. I'm going to watch out for the feds, and if they show up, I'm leaving.
Okay, you got it. Thanks, Cobra. Andrew, just so you know, that's
yes.
Cobra Staubs. He's a private investigator and a bounty hunter.
Oh, okay.
And we've become acquainted. What I was going to, we were talking about having to share the money with the crew, which with the family. Now,
yeah.
you were involved most closely with the Gambinos. Now, Gambino, I think when people think of the Gambinos, in addition to the Carlo Gambino, I think a lot of us think about John Gotti Sr.
Yes.
His name certainly is, and Paulie Castellano and so forth. And that was the family we're talking about, right, the Gambinos?
Yes, yes.
But you also stole with or committed crimes with members of other families, right? You were knew the, some of the Lucchese people and
yes.
Colombo people. And,
we had an unorthodox scenario. I had an unorthodox scenario, I should say. See, in this life, you're allowed to go out and network and steal and rob with whoever you can, just as long as at the end of the day, you know where your flag flies and you know where your money's got to go. All right? Under the circumstances, because what happens is then Brooklyn's a big area. And sometimes, you know, you grow up, you go to school with a kid growing up together, and you might go happen to, you know, be in the criminal activity, and you're under the Gambino flag, and he's under criminal activity, he's under the Lucchese family flag. And what happens is you still have that childhood friendship, and that's somebody you network with. Like if you have any stolen property or stolen goods, or you're in the business of trying to, you know, make a score, and you share information. You share information to a certain extent, you know. Of course, you know, you have to check it with the higher-ups if it's, you know, a real serious matter, if the family just wants to take a piece of it for themselves, whatever the case may be. But to earn with other guys, you got the green light to do so. And I did. I did. You know, I cashed in on those friendships growing up. I cashed in on them. Yeah, I'll give you, for instance, in the mid-90s, when I got out of prison, I was robbing banks with guys from the Genovese family. And we had a real strange scenario. There was three guys from the Genovese, one guy from the Banana, and myself. So each one of us had a different guy to answer to at the end of the day, but we all knew what we needed to do. There were some other crews there, like I had a friend of mine, Wild Bill Cotolo. He's passed on now. He was found dead a few years back. Me and his son were very close. He was from the Colombo crew. We committed crimes together. You know, we were doing counterfeit money together. We did counterfeiting for a while. We dealt drugs together. We put some money in the street together. I mean, there was another childhood friend of mine. So these are people, you know, you use whatever availability you have and whatever resource to make as much money as you possibly can, because at the end of the day, it's all about who produces. That's one thing about the mob that people don't understand. You know, it's all about money. You know, when you see this stuff on television or whatever, and they, you know, they try to put a spin on it where it looks glamorous and this and that, it's not. At the end of the day, it's about greed, money, and just self-preservation for the family. What you could do for us. And when you stop being productive and you stop being somebody who is deemed an earner or something like that, after a while, they get rid of you. And that doesn't necessarily mean murder. You know, you just don't become important anymore. You're only as important as your last favor with the mob. You know, and I think people need to really see it for what it is. You know?
So
I don't think. Go ahead.
So the portrayal in a lot of the TV shows and movies about the mob isn't necessarily accurate.
Well, you know what? I mean, in some aspects they are. In some aspects they are, but of course I guess they got to sell movie tickets or whatever the case they got to do, so they got to make it, you know, look, like I said, glamorous or try to put it on a pedestal for what it is. But at the end of the day, what it is it's a bunch of guys who have one thing in common, a common goal, and that is to go out, rob and steal and make as much money as possible, all doing this while avoiding arrest and law enforcement activity to come upon them. And basically, at the end of the day, that's all it is. You know, it's run like any other business, except you don't get a pink slip when you mess up. You get
okay.
two in the back of your head when you mess up, and that's what happens.
Okay.
And then, go right ahead.
Now, you mentioned a little bit earlier that your uncle was involved, I believe, as you call it, in the life. And
yes.
He was murdered. Do you know, or was that ever solved? Do you know who did it, or what happened?
Well, I'll tell you what happened was my uncle was a captain in the Genovese crime family. His name was Patty Mac Maccioli. Okay, he was a well respected man back in the day. And you know what? All I have is, you know, childhood memories of my uncle. Okay, but all I can say is that he was a man's man. All right, and he was made for that life. He was a gangster through and through. Okay, and what happened was he got caught up in mob politics back then, and that's what killed him. They pretty much had a handle on who killed him in the mid-90s. There was a captain in the Genovese crew named Sally Dogs Lombardi. Sally Dogs got caught on the telephone from prison mentioning the murder of my uncle. And I think, I don't know what happened with it, but I believe he had some sort of law enforcement trouble after that. Well, he wound up passing away last year anyway, or the year before. But, yes, it came back that it was Sally Lombardi who had murdered my uncle. And they killed my uncle's son, my cousin Johnny Boy, about a month later after they killed my Uncle Patty. So, yeah, so, you know, seeing that up close as a kid, and seeing what it did to my grandparents and seeing how it affected my dad and the rest of my family, these are lessons that I took in as I got older. And I started to be able to recognize dangers and, you know, my trusting of people as I got older. You know, it was definitely a learning tool. Mm-hmm. Because if somebody like him, who was bigger than life to me back then and bigger than life to a lot of people, could have got it like that, than a guy like me who's just a regular street guy trying to an up-and-coming guy in the street trying to make a name for himself, you know, and trying to put some money in his pocket, what do I got to protect myself?
Andrew, you said that your uncle's son, Johnny...
Johnny Maccioli, yeah.
Your cousin was killed shortly after your uncle. Now, was Johnny involved with the mob, too, or what happened?
Well, I think, you know, he was involved with criminal activity to some extent, you know, but... He wasn't entrenched in it like my uncle was. I think as far as my cousin Johnny was concerned, is that my cousin Johnny basically, I believe back then, got killed for, you know, for retribution reasons. And I really, really, I hold my Uncle Patty and that side of my family in very high regard. I really do. I mean, and like I said, I learned more about my uncle and his death than I did in his life because I was really too small at the time to really, you know, bang around with them or anything like that. So any information that I had upon them came from my father, my grandfather, people of that nature. And then as I got older, the other information came from guys who actually knew my uncle because I was involved with the Genovese family for a while doing some stuff. So I got to hear bits and pieces and really learn about his life in that aspect.
You mentioned, too, earlier that about you stopped in the club, you were a kid, and then became noticed a little bit by the wise guys in a club, and even after that, you met other people at the club. What club are we talking about?
Well, Nicky Krasow had a few clubs. He had one club on Pacific Street and Eastern Parkway in East New York, Brooklyn. That was one of the headquarters. It was a Knights of Columbus, and that was one of the headquarters there. We had another headquarters on East 93rd Street in Avenue Well in Canarsie. We had the luncheonette on the corner, which we used to hang out in, and directly across the street used to be a car service. We used to hang out inside the car service, and then it became a real estate agency, but it was just us inside. You weren't going to get no real estate.
Okay. Now, did you? Who was the boss when you first got involved with the Gambinos? Was that Castellano, or who was
in charge? When I first got involved with the Gambino crime family, I believe it was mid 1982. And at the time, the boss was Paul Castellano. The other boss was Anilio Della Croce O'Neill. My guy, Nicky Carrazza, was just a soldier at the time. And that's how it was then. That's how it was at that particular time, yeah.
And now, you got to meet Paulie Castellano, didn't you?
Well, what happened was I didn't so much as meet Paulie Castellano as I had a situation with Paul Castellano. What had happened was in like the mid, this seems to be, everybody seems to like this story, Dennis, and I tell you the truth, to me it was just, every day is heartbreaking for me because I realized how much money I lost back then. What happened was it was, let's go back what year it was. It was about maybe within a year before he was killed, 1984, I believe this was. We used to have like meetings with Nicky and the crew maybe twice a week at a diner late at night. And what happened was one night, we pull up to the diner, we get out of the car, we go inside to go see everybody, we walk in, say hello, and a friend of ours came in, and he turns around to me and this other gentleman that I was hanging around at the time, his name was Mike Giannotti. He asks us, he says, are you guys still in the car business? We said, yeah. He says, well, listen, he goes, there's a brand new Mercedes-Benz running outside. He said, it's running, the lights are on right now. So we took a look, we seen it was a convertible Mercedes, we walked outside, we seen some guy on his telephone. He was on the payphone on the corner there, and he was talking on the phone. So Mike says, yeah, you stand in front of him. I'll run around the other side of the car. I'll take the car and meet you back at your house. I said, okay. So I stand in front of the guy. He's yelling on the phone. He's busy, not paying attention. Mike jumps in the car. Mike goes to drive away. The guy tries to grab the door handle. I give him like a little bit of a hip check to keep him out of the way. The guy gets the handle. We drag him about 5 or 10 feet. He gets rolled around in the street. I run to the work car. I follow Mike to my house. We get home. It's a done deal. So we're just figuring it's like any other day, you know. We check the car. We check in, and we notice when we opened up the trunk of the car, in the back seat in the trunk of the car was a doctor's bag. In the doctor's bag, when we opened it, got it in the house, we opened it, there was a .38 caliber pistol on the top of it. And inside it was filled with a bunch of just plain white envelopes. So when I opened up the first envelope, I look at it, and in the corner of it, I seen a little seal. It said Meat Supreme. Now, I know that Paul Castellano owned Meat Supreme, but I didn't add two and two together at the time. So I open up one envelope, like $1,500 comes out. I open up another envelope, $600, another envelope, $300, another envelope, $2,000, another envelope, $700. After all was said and done, there was like $86,000 in the briefcase. So what happens is, no sooner than we finish counting the money, the phone rings. Nicky Carrazza called my house. He says, listen, kid, you still got that thing you took? I said, yeah. He goes, all right, listen, hold on to it because we got a problem. I said, well, what's the problem? So we go back down to the car. We're looking. We look in the glove box. We find a wallet. We open up the wallet, and there's a picture. The guy's driver's license, and we look at it, and we see his name was Bart Castellano. So now we're looking at each other, and we're saying, Jesus Christ, right? Yeah. And what happens is it turns out to be Paul Castellano's nephew or grand, I forget what he was, nephew or something like that, and he was in charge, I guess, of picking up all the money from the Meat Supremes or whatever else he was doing. And inside the bag was a ledger book. And he seemed really concerned about the ledger book. So they called me back and said, listen, whatever you do, don't read that fucking book. Excuse my language. Anyway, okay. I go and I say, okay, so, you know, as a kid, you know, what's the first thing you're going to do when they say that? You're going to open up the book.
That's right.
So we open up the book, we start looking through, and it's got all numbers, people's names next to it, a whole bunch of shit. So, make a long story short, 2 seconds later, the doorbell rings. And it's Jojo Carrazzo's son, little Jojo. He's a lawyer now today. He's the mob lawyer. There's another story behind that. I'll get to that later. But anyway, he knocks on the door. He goes, Angel. He goes, what's going on? He goes, you know, I got a phone call. Listen, whatever you've got here, got to go back. You know, it's a friend of my father's. He was even afraid to say Paul's name in my house. I started laughing. I said, I know who's this is. Don't worry about it. So what happened was we made an appointment with them for the following day. And all that night, all we did was sit up with each other, staring at each other, thinking of a way we could finagle to try to keep this money.
86.
Well, it was like a comedy. So the next morning, we wake up, we go, we return the car. We took $10 out of the money that we took from the car to put gas in it because he had no gas in the car. We bring it to the luncheonette. They come. They pick it up. We give it to him. We even return the pistol. We took the bullets out, returned the pistol, and he left. And here we are. We're sitting. We're hungry. We're young kids. We're in the street. We're trying to make a living over here. Nothing. The guy didn't give us nothing. No finder's fee. No nothing. So we're a little aggravated, right? So we go home. We go about our business. The next day, I get a phone call from a friend of mine. He says, did you get a basket of fruit? I said, basket of fruit? He goes, we got a basket of fruit. So I said, so we got a basket of fruit from Paul Castellano. I would have read something like, you did a very honorable thing, your friend Paul. And then we went to go see Nikki about it. Nikki told us that he was told from Paul that we all, that we had a favor coming if we ever needed a favor down the line. Well, I can't begin to tell you how many times I called that favor in, Dennis, because I was always in trouble. So every day we were, you know, we had a feather in our cap, so to speak. So every day we lived off that favor. But, yeah, it seems to be everybody's favorite story. To me, it's 86,000 down the tubes.
So, yeah, you, they've had to be tough turning that 86 grand back, huh? I mean,
yeah, especially, you know, we were young kids, you know. It wasn't like I wasn't doing the major, major things like I'm doing today. I mean, chopping cars, you know. Chopping cars, it, believe me, you make good money, but you break your ass. You know what I mean? You work all day.
Yeah.
You steal all night. You steal all night and you strip cars all day. You know, it's tough if you do 2-3 a day. If you could do 2-3 a day, at the end of the day, you're dragging, you know? And, yeah, so basically that was the end of that one.
So you got a fruit basket, but you got some favors, which kind of...
I got some favors with it down the line. And, you know, like I said, we was always in trouble back then with a lot of different scenarios. And we were always, you know, doing things, you know... The first big, you know, like 1984, that year was very hard for us anyway, 84, early 85, like that. We had lost our first friend of ours that finally got, you know, a friend of ours got killed. And it was the first real contact with losing a friend within that life back then. Mm-hmm. And it hit really close to home. A friend of mine had got murdered in a disco in Brooklyn. On Coney Island Avenue. The name of it was Promotions. A friend of mine, he was my partner, he was like my brother. You know, we were in the street together, we put money in the street together, he was my Shylock partner, and he wound up trying to defend another crew member of ours, cousin. He wanted to make sure she got home all right, and the guy she was with, they started to get into some words and this and that, and a fist fight ensued, and while he was on the floor fighting the kid, another guy from the Lucchese crew reached over and shot him while he was on the floor wrestling with the guy.
Hmm.
And he lost his life. He was only 19 years old. And it was really, really, you know, eye-opening at that particular time as to how, you know, your mortality and, you know, this life that you're in. You know what I mean? Now you started to see for what it was.
Did that provoke any revenge or was it just dropped?
Well, yes. Well, within a year, that particular person was dead. Within a year, he was dead, the person who killed him.
The Lucchese guy was dead.
Excuse me?
The guy from the Lucchese's?
Yeah, the guy from the Lucchese. He was dead within a year from that day. And the way I look back upon it now, when I was younger, of course, you know, you're piss and vinegar when you're a kid, and, you know, all you could think of every day is, you know, this, that, the other thing. But now when you look back upon it, you know, as an adult and things of that nature, two senseless killings, you know? Absolutely nothing. For nothing more than two guys having a regular, you know, one-on-one street fight. It turns out to be, you know, it devastates two families, bunch of friends, you know, people lose their brothers. And it's just, you know, it's, when you look upon it, that's what I mean, how people see in Hollywood, how they glamorize these things. But there's real people who bleed real blood, and there's people who cry real tears. Lives are ruined, you know? And people don't really see the full picture.
And just to make sure I'm correct on this, in a case like this, like you're talking about, where your friend was killed. Now, if somebody, I'm not saying it was you, but if somebody is upset about that, a friend of your friends, be it you or whoever, and wants to deal with this Lucchese character from the Lucchese.
Yeah.
You can't just do that, right? Or there's got to be
a
protocol.
Well, I tell you the truth. You go through, you know, you go through your protocol, but when something blatant like that happens, everybody's watching. Your boss is watching. The streets are watching. Other crews are watching. Everybody wants to see what's going to happen with that scenario. Because believe it or not, whether you want to know it or not, or you want to own up to it or not, everybody who's involved around that area who has anything to do with crime is waiting to see the reaction of what happens there. Because the very next step is that if nothing ever happens, they know that anybody within this crew is a target from that moment on.
Okay.
Because they know it's never going to escalate and go into, you know, and that's what made my crew that much more dangerous than other people, because we were always willing to go a step above other people. So, you know, I was explaining to somebody yesterday, I think we were talking about it, and I said, if somebody, you know, wanted to put a stop to something, and they wanted to come out and they wanted to, you know, be defiant, we would find a way to humble that person. Now, if we couldn't do it with our hands, we'd hit him with a stick. We couldn't do it with a stick, we'd shoot him. So what you did was, that's what made it successful. That's what made organized crime successful, because you're willing to go beyond what a reasonable person or person who thinks, you know, who's a citizen. Citizens don't think about going to these sort of levels to get a point across, and that's what made it so convincing. It's what carried people through. But the life in itself is all baloney. You know what I mean? Because it's 85% fear, 15% reaction. So, of course, there's very dangerous people in organized crime. There's very dangerous characters. I was involved in a number of shootings in my life. I'm not proud of them, but it is what it is. And all I can tell you is that, all I can say is that there's a lot of other guys in the life who were portrayed as tough guys but never broke an ache. And, you know, I'm not trying to put medals on myself at all, but at least I know what my capabilities were. There's guys out there who hold captain status in a crime family today who never committed an act of violence in their life. And that and nepotism is what destroyed organized crime today. Because you've got guys in positions who don't belong in positions, and the guys who deserve the positions, who were the guys who were good at their jobs, the street guys, the earners, the guys who did the work for the family, when the boss was getting ready to go to jail, the boss don't want a guy who's capable in his position. He wants to put somebody in the position that he could control. Because if he can control that guy, his family could eat for the next 10 years. But if you're a capable guy and you deserve that position, he knows when he comes home from jail, he ain't never getting that position back. And that's how it weakened the links over the years.
By putting guys in who really didn't deserve it.
Of course not. And you know what? It's like any other company. It's very political. It's very political. You know, it's a very political thing. You know, you get a boss who doesn't like you. Like, look at me. I was committing crimes with all these guys from other crews and this and that. And after a while, it caused a little friction for me with Nicky Carrazzo. Because as his career grew, when he went from regular soldier to captain, I think he became a captain when Gene Gotti went to jail in 80. I forget what year Gene went to jail, in 87, I think it was. He became the captain when Gene went away, or acting captain status, whatever you want to call it. And then in 1996, he became the boss. So I was with him through those years as he developed into the boss of the Gambino crime family. And he wasn't the boss at first. He sat on a panel with John Jr. and Jackie Knows. They had like a panel, like a three-member panel to run the day-to-day activities. And then, you know, John Jr. and Jackie Knows, they were no match for Nicky. I mean, Nicky was an old-school gangster. Old school. He had a brother with a ton of money who had a tremendous crew out in Queens. He had a lot behind him, and they were no match for him. You know, so I guess they took it, you know, they gave him the reins to run it. He didn't last very long, I think, because when we had the status hearing, we had a meeting, Dennis. The meeting was, being that Nicky knew he was going to take over the family, the meeting was to see a boss isn't allowed to have a crew, because then it shows favoritism. Mm-hmm. So the boss has to, if you become boss, you had a crew, what you got to do is you got to take your crew and dismantle it. You got to put your crew with other guys within the family. You get to keep one or two guys, I think, to run your errands and do some stuff like that. but you can't have your own crew. So we had to hear, you know, like a status meeting with Nikki on who was going to go where. And that's how I knew that he was going to take over everything. But within 5 days after that status hearing, he was already getting locked up, and he knew he was going to get locked up. At that meeting, he had said he was going to get locked up. So he knew the writing was on the wall. You know, the writing was on the wall already, so he didn't really get a chance to actually reap the rewards of being a boss. And he went away. He had an 8-year sentence back then. I think in 96 when he got arrested, I think he copped a plea. He wound up doing 8 years.
Oh, now where is he now?
Well, right now, let me tell you how it played out. In 1989, I went to prison. I came home. I came home in 1994. I was on the work program for a while. I got paroled. I was in the street 30 months. 17 of those months, I was on the run, Dennis. I was a fugitive from justice for about 17 months. A partner of mine from the Lucchese family, we were robbing drug dealers together. We were dealing drugs together and some other stuff. We were making a ton of money. And what happened was, his crew and my crew were the only two crews within our area. So there was a lot of competition within our crews. So at first, Nikki gave me the green light to do it because it didn't matter who I stole with, you know, just as long as I, you know, did my part financially or whatever the case may be. But when the pressure started mounting and the friction was coming, I was getting the word back. He didn't want me to commit crimes with my friend Robert anymore. My friend's name was Robert Arena, and me and him were childhood friends, grew up, and we became closer as we got older, even though, you know, he had his, who he had answered to and who I had answered to. And I wasn't going to listen to that because, number one, I was making big money. Number two, he's a childhood friend of mine, and I trusted him more than I trusted some guys in my own crew. And that trust turned out to be 100% right, because when Robert was getting the same feedback from the guys on his side of the family, Robert came to warn me that they were looking to kill me on his side of the family. And a crew member of ours wound up dead back in 1995, and they were blaming my friend Robert for the murder. So that also brought friction to our business transactions. And it all came to a head one day, Dennis, when we robbed this drug dealer from Manhattan who also had organized crime ties. And that robbery altered the lives of so many people who we're talking about today. What happened was, after that robbery, they came forward and they complained to my boss at the time, which was Nikki. Nikki, in turn, asked me to return some of the marijuana that I robbed. I think I robbed like 400 or 500 pounds. I think we sold it for like, I don't know, 600 or 700 pounds a piece. We made some really good money. Anyway, we only had very little product left. We returned some of the product to show a good faith. But we knew that there was a problem behind there. Now, with the death of a crew member of mine and then blaming Robert for that, it gave Nikki the green light, and they killed my friend Robert. And what had happened like a day before...
Nikki did?
Yes. And what had happened, like, the day before they killed my friend Robert, they called me in and told me that there was going to be some work to be done, and I needed to be at a location where they could reach me within 24 hours and not to leave that location until, you know, until they called. And I waited there, but they never called me. I found out my friend Robert was killed that morning. Somebody called my house at 5 o'clock in the morning and told me my friend Robert had got shot. He got killed in a brutal way. He got machine guns. He got like 40 bullet holes in him. I mean, it was just a massacre. And it was something that was just, didn't have to happen. And what had happened was, then I knew that it was either they were going to use me to lure Robert, or they were going to kill me and Robert at the same time. But the phone call never came. And then what had happened was, the next day, we had a meeting amongst our crew after Robert's death about what to do. And I was told that I was supposed to go to the funeral and deny everything, because they were already looking at our crew for the murder, because a crew member of ours is, back then they had beepers. The beeper was found at the foot of the car, outside the driver's door, outside where his two bodies were found. And my phone number was on the beeper.
Oh boy.
So what happened was, they traced the beeper back to Michael Iannotti, and my phone number's in the beeper. They know law enforcement starts investigating, knows that Robert and me are partners in the street doing stuff. So obviously I became the first suspect in that homicide. And I remember going to the parole office, and I remember walking in, and a friend of mine coming into the parole office telling me that there was two detectives downstairs and that they're looking to come up to speak to my parole officer about me. They're mentioning my name. So what I did was I waited for law enforcement to come up. I waited for them to get buzzed in the office. As soon as they got buzzed in the office, they asked my parole officer. I ran out of parole, and I went on a run. And when I was on the run, that's when I knew that it was only a matter of time before I was next. The difference between me and Robert was they could have killed me anytime they wanted to because all they had to do was call me in at that particular time. And it altered my life because it put me in a position to, I violated parole, I was going to go back to jail. Later on, but that 17 months that I was running, that's when I was robbing banks with the guys from the Genovese crew and some guys from the Gambino crew from Bensonhurst, the 17th Avenue crew. Sammy Gravano's old crew.
Sammy the Bull.
And, excuse me?
Sammy the Bull.
Yeah, Sammy the Bull. And what had happened was, I was doing so good on the run, but I was getting pressured from my boss and the crew to give myself in so they could see what kind of evidence law enforcement had. I was like the guinea pig. No pun intended, because I'm Italian either. But that was it. I was the guinea pig in that aspect of it. And I seen the writing on the wall. I was expendable. And when we had that status hearing, Nikki had told me before he went to jail that, you know, when he goes to jail, there's going to be a lot of work to be done. And Nikki pretty much had a list of guys that he was going to be looking to get rid of while he was in prison. And John Gotti Jr. was first on that list.
He wanted to have Gotti killed.
Yeah. And he told me, his exact words were, when he goes to jail, there'll be a lot of work to do, and we're going to start with that baby Huey out in Queens. So I looked at him, I said, okay. And that was it. And when I gave that information, the funny part is that when John Gotti and Mike Anati go on trial for the Curtis Wheeler shooting, Mike Anati was charged with the double homicide of my friend Robert and Thomas Moringa. And I know in the 302 information that a witness like myself gives to the government, I'm sure John Gotti had to read the part that we were going to kill him, and he had to eat lunch with Mike Anati every day knowing that Mike was going to be the guy to kill him. That must have been an interesting lunch date they had.
Oh, got it, yes.
Yeah, there must have been a lot of tension at that table. But for the most part, that scenario altered the lives of me because it put me on the run. It put me in a non-trusting situation. It got me arrested, and it saved my life, actually. That arrest saved my life because I was on an oxygen tank. I wouldn't have made it past any day. When I look back on it, Dennis, any day after 1996 was a gift from God for me. You know, I should be dead in 12 years already. And, you know, that's why I try to make the best out of it now, you know, when I look back upon it. In 2004, when they were looking at Nicky Carrazzo for the double homicide, his nephew, the lawyer, JoJo, had made a comment that his uncle would never have nothing to do with drug dealers, never to do with this, that. He's innocent. And yet, in 2008, he went in America's Most Wanted, took off when the indictment came down. And in 2008, he pleaded guilty. He didn't even go to trial. I was on a plane, Dennis. I was on a plane coming in to testify, thinking that I was going to go testify at his trial. When I landed the plane, the agent met me at the airport and told me, you can go home. He said he took a plea while you were in the air. And he pleaded guilty to the two homicides. And he got a sweetheart of a deal, but he's an older guy, so his life is over anyway. You know, he got a 15-year sentence, I believe. When he gets out, he'll be 80-some-odd years old with 5 years supervised release, whatever he has. I think his criminal career, as we could say, is probably pretty much over.
So now, did you actually go into witness protection?
I had to finish doing my, you know, people have another thing. They think that just because you become a witness that you don't go to jail. I went to jail for a number of years. I got jail 2001, and I went to witness program in 2001, and I was in a witness program a short time, I think a little bit over a year, something like that. And I went on my own. I didn't want to deal with the stipulations. I wanted to see my family. I wanted to be able to come and go as I please. And people think like the witness program is like a welfare thing. People don't understand. It's a shot. It's a second shot at life. And you got to make that. You hold the key to make the best out of it. If you don't want to make the best out of it, Dennis, it's, how can I say it? You're going to wind up going back. Because like anybody else, if you only know criminal activity your whole life, and things are bad and things are rough, you're going to wind up going back doing what you only know. I wanted to take myself out of the equation. So I made the best possible choices I could make to make the best out of it, and I did. And thank God I did, because that was the scariest time of my life, was being a fucking citizen. To be honest with you, because I never knew how to do that. I never had a legitimate job in my life. Now all of a sudden, I got to be Joe Citizen. I got to go out, get a job, do this, do that. I opened up a business, thank God. I made a few dollars, you know, I moved on, and God blessed me in that capacity. I'm still active with the FBI today, and there's some more cases coming on down the line, which I can't discuss, and I've been cooperating now with the government since 97, and I'm still active. So the wheels of justice, they move pretty slowly, as you can see.
So you voluntarily left witness protection for the reasons you mentioned. But
I just know what it was, Dennis. I wanted to have some sort of contact with my family, because when you're in the witness program, if your family didn't come with you and your family still stays where they live or whatever else, you can't contact them unless you do it through the Marshal Service. And the Marshal Service was very good to me. They treated me very fairly. You know, I have no complaints as far as that's concerned. I went in. I did what was expected of me. I knew that it wasn't going to be easy. A guy like me, Dennis, they send you halfway, you know, they send you around the country somewhere, and believe me, my friend, I stood out. You know, because right away, as soon as you open up your mouth, people know you're from the East Coast, one way or another.
Uh-huh.
So although I couldn't hide that aspect of it, I pretty much had to reinvent myself. And that in itself is a job.
Andrew, let me just interrupt for just a second. We got a question in the chat room. Did Gotti Jr. call the hit on Curtis?
On Curtis Wheeler?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
Well, that's what happened in 1992. John was a little bitter and a little upset about his father going to prison. So when I look back upon it, I look upon it as John acted out in anger, knowing that his father was never going to come home, or whatever the case may be. Curtis Wheeler was on the radio, talking, doing his stuff, and I think a few things were said about John Sr., and John Jr. was in the position at the time to make sure that, you know, and he made the decision and it changed his life as well. Because look at that. Now, the guy Mike Inati I spoke of with the double homicide was the one that shot Curtis Wheeler.
Oh, he was?
Okay. Yes. He was the one that shot Curtis Wheeler. And now there's a scenario for you, because when you look back about it, I mean, like right now John's on trial. He's on trial right now as we speak. And this is like his fifth trial. And here's a guy who lived insulated his whole life. And what I can't understand, Dennis, is this. Although I come from a family that was involved in organized crime, just like John Jr. did, I'm not comparing myself to him in any way, at all. But all I'm saying is that his father had the financial capacity that anything this kid wanted to do, he would have been successful at, because his father would have seen to it that his business has flourished. So I don't know why this kid chose a life of crime. I see that with other guys from other families as well, that their fathers were big money. I was talking about it today. I was very good friends with Wild Bill Cotola's son from the Columbo crew. Now, his father, before he passed on, he was worth tons of money. I don't know why this kid who went to school was a very good kid, and I don't see how this kid could have wanted that life for himself. I just don't see why you would go into a life of crime like that if you had the financial means to do anything you wanted. I mean, I scratch my head to that. I mean, I did it because I didn't have the rich parents or anything like this. I seen it as a way to get myself up and out. These guys didn't have to do that. Although I really commend Wild Bill's son for what he did. He wore wire on the guys that killed his father. To me, that is very, very, very honorable thing to do. You know, and it showed a lot of guts to do that.
Do you think the reason that these these guys who don't have to steal because they have the financial resources that they wouldn't have to. Do you think it's just the excitement?
I don't know if it's so much the excitement. You know what I think it is? And, you know, and listen, I'm not throwing stones at anybody. All I could say is that I know ego plays a part. I know that a lot of these guys that grow up with fathers and people like that in the life, I think they just want to prove themselves to their fathers and to the guys that they're the same way, or they look up to their fathers so much that they figure this is what they want to do. But I think now if you would ask the same guys, like I know Wild Bill's son was in the program as well, I think if you would ask him today, you know, if the same scenario came from his, with his kids, I would have to guess that this guy would jump to a fire not to let his kids get involved in this life. See, me, that's what I would do. I would do whatever it took to make sure my kids never, never had a shot. And look at me, Dennis. I lost, me becoming a witness, I lost my family. I haven't seen my son in 8 years. My son doesn't even know what baseball team I like. He doesn't know what baseball team I like, what's my favorite color, nothing. All the time took that away from me. They took it away from me, you know, and that's the price I paid for being a witness. Because my son and his mother, my ex-wife, they decided that, you know, I'm not going to say they condemned my decision, but I was divorced from her, and she had made friendships with people within my life. She tried to keep those friendships, but I don't think she realizes that these people are nobody's friends. See, my neighbor, they got this mindset, Dennis. It's okay, and it's acceptable to kill your best friend, but don't you dare tell on him.
No.
Now, if that's not sick thinking, I don't know what is.
Let me ask you this now. You testified against Gotti Jr. You say there's other stuff possibly down the road for you, yet you're not in witness protection. Are you concerned about your safety?
Dennis, I did so much in my life, and I did so much bad. Listen, they wanted to kill me before I became a witness. So the threat level doesn't change, okay? I am very, very cautious to the point where I respect the game enough to know that I'm not going to put myself in harm's way for stupid reasons. But I also know that I'm a man. And I also know that if trouble comes my way, I'll deal with it the way I always dealt with it. And you know what? Listen, I'm not saying that I'm bigger and better than the next man. All I do is know is that I made my decisions based on the position that I was put in and knowing what my options were. And I chose this path. And I don't apologize for that. Because I'm not going to be honorable to a life that wasn't honorable to me. You know?
I understand.
And I think, you know, I respect the game enough to be cautious enough, and I'm always aware of my surroundings or who's around me, and those instincts I'll never lose. But those, whether I was a witness or not, those instincts will always be inside me because I did too much in my life, Dennis. I hurt a lot of people in my life. Like I said, I'm not proud of it. You know, I was involved in a lot of violent things, and, you know, that's what people don't realize, you know, when you're in this life. You know, it's like a runaway train. You know, when the wreck is done, you got to look behind you and see what happened. And now that I was able to, I was blessed enough to know to look behind me and see what happened. That's why I'm trying to take this, all the negative in my life, and try to make a positive out of it. I'm not going to change the world, but at least I could help some kid who thinks that he's going to rise to the top. There's no happy endings. You want to be a stand-up guy and go to prison and do it 50 years? You do it. There's no happy endings. Your family suffers. You want to become a government witness and go get moved out of the country, out of the state, away from your family? There's no happy ending for that guy. The other guy who never makes it on either side winds up dead in the street. There's no happy ending for him. It's a deal with the devil to get involved in that life. Very few guys were able to reap the rewards of what they did over the years, live to tell about it, and see their kids grow and enjoy their grandchildren. Very few guys.
You're working with kids now to some degree, aren't you?
What I'm trying to do now, there's a few organizations I'm trying to, you know, to work with. I've been invited to a few venues around the country with police departments, and just to have talks with kids and gangs and stuff of that nature, and to work with law enforcement on some capacity on some of the things that I was involved in, sort of like a teaching technique to help out some way or another. You know, because at this stage of the game, Dennis, it's all about if you don't try to make a positive change, if you're not sincere to it, then everybody who looks at you, no matter what aspirations you have, they're never going to take you serious as a regular person. They're always going to think that you're that same person you were, that you can't be trusted, that, you know, you still got criminal stuff on your mind, or you got this or that. I told some guy today, I said, you know what? The level of awareness is always around me. I walk into a bank, I'm always looking for the weak spots. I was a bank robber. When I go here, it's just, but you don't follow through on them. You just, you know, you take it as, listen, it's just instinct. I did it for so many years, this is what I do. I go out at whatever, I see things, I see Brinks trucks, whatever, I think on the same frame of mind. I don't act upon them, those days are over for me. But the instinct is still there. You know, and you try to pick up, like I said, weak spots or this and that. Maybe someday down the line I'll be a security consultant for a company or something like that. Right now it's just day by day, my friend. It's just day by day.
But do you ever have a day or a moment now where you think you wish you were back in the life?
You know what? There's a lot of guys that I developed, you know, childhood friendships with and growing up or whatever, and there's a lot of guys I wish that I could see, you know, have a beer with, you know, enjoy them, go to a bowl game and talk about stuff, and that's what I miss from the life. Dennis, believe me when I tell you, take the most stressful moment in your life, times it by 1,000, and then times it by 2,000 after that, and that is dealing with organized crime and the guys you got to deal with. Every day you got to remember the things you spoke to this guy about, what you lied about. Who this guy? Why does this guy want to speak to me? That guy, this guy. I was on the run. I was worried about my crew killing me, had the FBI looking for me, had the parole department looking for me. I had a beef with another family. Believe me, it's not a life for anybody. Yeah, I think back upon it. There were some good times. There was a lot of good times. But those good times are never worth the loss of your family. And they're never lost time of your life. Life is short. You come around once. You got to make the best of it. It's quality of life from this moment on. Plain and simple, quality of life. Sure, I think about it. I did a lot of things. I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of money. I was a young guy with a lot of money. I was driving an $88,000 car. You know what I mean? I was living the fast life, and I thought it would never end. How wrong I was, my friend. How wrong I was. You know?
Let me ask you, Andrew, did you ever see the movie Goodfellas, the Henry Hill?
Sure.
Story? How realistic was that in the lifestyle they portrayed in the movie?
Well, the lifestyle was like that because I knew the guys from that crew that Henry was around. Paulie Vario had went away. I was a very young guy, but I knew Petey Vario. I knew his Petey Vario's son, Pork Chops. I knew those guys from the Lucchese crew over there. Danny could tell you wind up taking over that crew at a later date. I mean, I know all about that. That thing, Jimmy Burke, he was a legend. If you're a thief, Jimmy Burke was a legend. You knew about these guys. You knew. Yeah, the lifestyle was like that. It's fast money, and you're riding it thinking you got a license to do all of these things. And that's what it was. You thought you had a license to do so. You know, you never stopped to think, wow, I better start saving for a rainy day. No, I never thought about saving. I never thought about anything like that because to me, I always thought, okay, if this ends, we could do this. A door always opened. A door was always open, and there was always somebody who needed something or somebody who was always in some sort of trouble, somebody you could take advantage of to get something done. That's the mindset that they put you on from day one, that everybody outside that door within that crew that you're in is a victim unless otherwise said.
Wow.
Yeah, well, people really don't understand that, you know, and as far as friends, you know what the sad part is, Dennis? You grow up with a guy, you go on your first dates together, you went to high school together, you hung out with each other, you did your stuff, you committed crimes together, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you need me, I'm there for you. We're doing work together, everything. And then one day, some guy who didn't grow up with us, and he just happens to be our boss, wants you dead. What am I supposed to do? I got to kill you for him? Please. And that's the sad part of the life. You got guys that will actually do that, ruin 30 years of friendship so they can get themselves a badge or be looked at in a positive light by some guy who don't care if you live or die anyway. He just wants you for the earning power you have.
Andrew, we're going to get cut off. I don't know where the hour went to here. We only got about 10 seconds, and we're going to get cut off.
All right.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. It's really been very informative.
Hey, listen, it was a pleasure. And make sure you enjoy your vacation.
I sure will, and I'll hopefully see you in a few weeks.
And call me as soon as you get back.
Will do, Andrew. Thanks a million.
All right. Thank you, Dennis. Have a good night.
Good night. Good night. And thanks, everybody, for listening tonight, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Have a good night. Bye-bye.